For Politico, I'm Ryan Heath, and this is Global Insider. In recent weeks, we've been flooded with images of what appear to be war crimes in Ukraine. It's horrific, but such crimes are not as rare as we would like them to be. And the tendency of the world is to move slowly, or to look away when this happens. There's no justice for the Syrian victims of chemical weapons. It took years for governments to even begin declaring genocide against the Rohingya population of Myanmar and the Uyghurs in China. When prosecutions do happen, they can take 20 years to get moving. That's the timeline of a new trial over atrocities in Sudan dating back to the early 2000s. In Europe, the debate about war crimes is long and painful, partly because of the sheer scale of the crimes of the Nazis in the 1930s and 1940s. And I might add, the crimes of Stalin. Let's remember, Ukrainians were mass victims of both Nazi Germany and the Soviets. So where do we go from here? And what's different about prosecuting these most heinous crimes compared to the 1940s? To help us answer those questions is a writer who has a new book out in May on the genealogy of war crimes, and who, luck would have it, has a special place in my heart because she helped me launch the Brussels Playbook for Politico back in 2015. Joining us now on Global Insider is Linda Kintzler, who is a writer who has covered Ukraine for many years. But more than that, we are having her on because she has specifically covered war crimes and how Soviet government officials attempted to prosecute war crimes going back to World War II, even during World War II. And I thought there might be some lessons that all of you could learn from all the work Linda has done on that book. So maybe, Linda, let's just start with the book. First of all, welcome.
Thank you.
The book is called Come to This Court and Cry. What's it about, apart from crying?
So I'll start with the title. The title is one of the final lines of the concluding argument by Sir Hartley Chakras, who is the chief British prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. And he conjured this image of humanity kind of bedraggled and bleeding after the dislocations of World War II, coming to the Nuremberg courtroom and looking the judges in the face, and said, "Humanity comes to this court and cries, these are our laws, let them prevail." And the reason it's the title of the book is not only because it's one of the most profound and kind of shaking speeches of the Nuremberg proceedings, but also because it happened to be left upon the body of a Nazi who was assassinated in 1965 by Mossad agents. And my book tells the story of that assassinated man's posthumous criminal investigation in what is now Latvia. So it's kind of a story about how the kind of long efforts to prosecute war crimes in the 20th century, how they are very much ongoing, and the difficulties of securing testimonies then and now.
There's a lot to unpack there, but the core of it is so important. Europe said never again back in the 1940s, and here we are again, first of all. One might argue we were already back here in the 1990s in the Balkan Wars, but we're definitely back at all of these problems again. And you hint at this point that while it can be very important to prosecute a war crime, it can take decades for that to happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's a form of justice, but it doesn't necessarily solve much of the pain or the problems of now.
Yeah. So what's interesting about the Chakras speech is that if you read it, actually the subject of it is about a German massacre of Jewish citizens that took place in Dubno, Ukraine. And I think what many people don't realize about Nuremberg, which is important to highlight now because it's being revisited as a model for how we could prosecute what is going on in Ukraine right now, it happened at the time when a lot of the evidence about what actually happened during World War II had not been widely distributed. And so the vast majority of the evidence presented at Nuremberg had to do with crimes committed on the territory of Eastern Europe. It was not yet clear what had occurred in Western Europe and by what mechanisms. And the kind of minutes of the Wannsee conference had not yet been discovered. And so I think that's one of the big things to understand is that we are in this moment. This is a very different war. The evidence is being distributed en masse on social media. You know, it's being collected by all kinds of sources. And while that is an immense advantage that we have towards documenting number one and prosecuting number two, it also will complicate the efforts to prosecute perpetrators that are, you know, starting now and will probably be going for decades to come.
The two things that jump out in my mind are, one, any of the evidence can be subject to claims of misinformation and disinformation. Like, we already see Russia essentially saying that it's fake news, this evidence that clearly is in circulation in many places. And then it also normalizes it in a way where there's no shock value to the evidence being presented. You do have a sense that somehow the world has got the memory of a goldfish these days, and the world in many respects will move on before justice can begin to unfold.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the unfortunate realities, but it's also one of the big reasons why you're seeing people try to say, okay, we've had the lessons of the last 70 years, 80 years that have illustrated how imperfect, how kind of impartial these transitional justice mechanisms are. And yet we still reach for them as a kind of first mechanism. You know, I keep thinking about the sign that I think circulated on social media and that Ukrainian activists put up when the invasion just began that said, "For Russian soldiers, all roads lead to The Hague." First of all, there are so many different courts that sit in The Hague. A lot of people have been talking about the International Criminal Court's potential role in prosecutions, and I do think that they have a really critical role to play. But when I was thinking about that sign, I just thought, you know, we know that whatever justice will be done, and I'm sure it will be done, I have to believe that it will be done, will not be enough. And that's kind of the nature of this. We have to think about these proceedings as remainders almost, you know, and accept the fact that it's one kind of reckoning and it's not the ultimate and it cannot be the only form.
Absolutely. If you have any ideas on other forms of reckoning, I won't stop you sharing them.
All of these obvious options are deeply flawed, you know, and people are coming up with inventive solutions or brainstorming them as fast as they can, basically, you know, whether it is creating a special tribunal like the Nuremberg model for what's going on in Ukraine, or simply disseminating, narrativizing, illustrating testimonies as much as we can, and kind of acknowledging that that is one way of kind of winning the war, is by winning the narrative, especially because Russia insists on perverting it. In many ways, it is this kind of propaganda narrative kind of situation.
That makes me think of the high politics or the ideological contest that you can't separate these crimes and alleged crimes from. The Soviets had a clear interest in prosecuting the Nazis because there were two competing systems.
Yeah.
And they wanted to create their Soviet empire across Eastern Europe. And this was one of the ways for legitimizing that control and that interest. So that's one level. And at another level, we didn't have forums like the International Criminal Court at the time. So you end up with forums like a special tribunal in Nuremberg. And that could be controversial now because it's something outside of the UN system. So you have European countries, for example, probably not wanting to go down that path because they want to strengthen the UN, not weaken it. Then separately, if you try and make the International Criminal Court's work and its investigation as successful as possible, that could be great, but the US isn't part of the International Criminal Court, so it does not have an interest necessarily in making that the forum.
One of the most fascinating things for me in watching the commentary about Ukraine come about is thinking about how the Russian army is now perpetrating the very same crimes which previous generations of Soviet officials documented. It's so sinister how the images match up almost in Kharkiv or in Kherson or in Odessa or Mariupol, certainly, where you can look at the images of what the Nazis did to these places, and then you can look at what's doing right now by Russian forces, and the kind of parallels are obviously disturbing to anyone. And it seems very clear that war crimes at the very least are being perpetrated there. But I think that what people don't really understand is how immediately the Soviets documented and sent forensic teams to investigate genocide throughout the formerly occupied territories, and how important that evidence was for the trials that would come. I understand that now everything is going to be contested, and the velocity at which is contested is truly unprecedented. But the fact of that contestation is not new. The Nazis also said, you know, no, this is lies. No, we didn't murder innocent civilians. We just sent them to the doctor. You know, there were always these kinds of ridiculous euphemisms.
We had a series of meetings taking place over the last 24 hours. We're speaking on Monday, April 11. So Josep Borrell, who's the chief EU diplomat, met with Karim Khan, who is the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, and essentially just offered the EU's support in training investigators to collect evidence to the highest standards possible in Ukraine. And what a mess that must be, given everything else people have to live with in Ukraine. And the Dutch foreign minister, Wopke Hoekstra, he had another meeting today with Karim Khan. And the Dutch government were the government that led the prosecution over MH17, which was the airliner that the Russians shot down over Ukraine, going back quite a few years now. Is that a hopeful sign for you, or do we need to see a lot more effort and resources being put into these questions to get these cases, to get this evidence up to the standard needed to have successful prosecution?
Well, one thing that is extremely clear is that there will be no shortage of evidence. And I think it's an amazing thing that so many governments are already working with Ukrainian authorities to do so and kind of saying, this is what we will need. The bigger danger is that a lot of the more crowdsourced stuff, if it's particularly like cell phone videos or audio recordings, things like that, that are not only vulnerable to start with, but also once people finally get to leave, if they get to leave these besieged cities, they are ordered to delete files from their phones. And so we cannot know how much we are losing in real time.
And is that in the sense of, let's say, a humanitarian corridor does become functional around a given city? You would have Russian armed forces sort of providing illegal checkpoints, basically, where, okay, we're going to let the corridor happen, but hand over your phone, or we're wiping your phone, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so basically we know that in places where Russian troops have taken over, one of the first things they've done is confiscate people's cell phones. We also know people who have managed to escape from Mariupol have reported that they had to either delete things from their phones or just hand over their phones. So in that sense, like, we really do not know how much we are losing and how fast we are losing it. But on the subject of the Dutch, I think it's interesting, and I do think they have a huge role to play because they have been leading the MH17 prosecution, which, for people who don't know, has been taking place in the district court of The Hague. You know, it's a local court. First of all, every single proceeding is being live streamed for public consumption, which is a really interesting move. When the trial did open, it was clear that they wanted it to be a kind of international affair, an international spectacle, in the way that these world trials tend to be. And it just hasn't been. And I think that's a huge warning for everyone right now who is thinking about how we prosecute what's going on in Ukraine, is that, first of all, this is part of the same war. It's a kind of continuation. And the international courts that are already conducting investigations, this new phase of the war is being attached to all the crimes that have already been committed and are still being actively investigated. You know, you're still seeing resolutions from 2014, 2015 finally make their way through these courts. And so just the duration of these proceedings is one thing that I think everyone is going to have to rapidly accept, I suppose. And the other thing is just the mediation, right? It's not just the circulation of evidence that we're seeing on social media, but probably if the MH17 model is any indication, it will also be the prosecutions that circulate.
And are we in a situation where we'll ever be able to haul Russian individuals before these courts? Does it make a difference what court you go before, where you know, maybe international arrest warrants are going to work better if it's the International Criminal Court rather than the district court. Or perhaps there's a series of civil claims that need to be made, though I imagine it would be very hard to extract cash. But you could have frozen Russian assets, for example, could be used to compensate victims later on down the line in these court cases.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the proceedings to watch is this UCOS arbitration, which is the biggest arbitral kind of contestation in history and has to do with confiscated assets of shareholders of UCOS. They've been fighting for it for, I don't know, decades now. And
that's the big Russian oil company that Mikhail Khodorkovsky ran before he became prisoner number one in the oligarch show trials that Putin put in.
Correct. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of avenues. There's a lot of wealth that could be seized if governments continue to have the wherewithal to do so. That could be used for kind of the settlement of claims. But of course, we look to the MH17 trial and we see that three of the defendants are being tried in absentia and only one of them has retained counsel. The other option is, okay, if you want to have non-symbolic or, you know, whatever, in my reductive way of thinking about this, like real trials, you would likely only be able to prosecute lower level soldiers. For instance, some of the prisoners of war, you could see Ukrainian domestic courts putting them on trial. And I do think we're likely to see that. And that might be kind of locally effective, but obviously it would not penalize the organizing, the waging of an aggressive war.
Yeah, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You let many of the enablers, the lower level people, get away with real war crimes if you don't go after everybody. And if you go after the lower level operatives, you're not going to the absolute heart of the problem. But I guess if there's anything we've learned from evil and oppressive regimes, is it certainly takes a village. It's not just one nasty guy at the top. And it is almost always a guy running the show. Thousands of people that make it happen at lower levels who all had choices and who made evil choices.
Yeah. And I think it's going to ultimately be up to every nation, obviously Ukraine first and foremost amongst them, to decide for themselves what kind of prosecutions they would like to see, right? Because you can see Ukrainians trying individual Russian soldiers and also participating in an international tribunal of high command, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not a new problem. We've seen this happen time and time again, unfortunately, as genocide has recurred. But the question is, okay, where do these prosecutions stop? And what is most effective? And who do we pardon? Who do we put in jail? And where are those lines? And I think here, it's just kind of going to be a heartbreaking mess for as long as this goes on.
And then we've got the question of a broader sense of justice for the survivors and whatever is left of Ukraine when this war is over. So in historical terms, Ukraine has really suffered so much. It suffered a deliberate mass starvation, which many would categorize as genocide, in the 1930s at the hands of Stalin. It suffered at the hands of the Nazis in the 1940s. And it has suffered for at least 8 years now, again, under repeated Russian attacks and invasions. And I wonder if something special is required now for Ukraine. And that's tough, because then you balance that against all of the attention and all of the resources that have been directed at Ukraine, which often weren't there for Syrians suffering similar atrocities, or which the world basically doesn't pay attention to if it happens in Africa, because it somehow expects those things to happen in Africa. Do you have any sense of what else can be done beyond the case of prosecutions and trials that can help protect Ukrainians in the future?
Yeah. Well, I think the Syria example is really illustrative in many ways. And of course, the complication being there that the president of Syria and his regime welcomed and perpetrated the atrocities. And it wasn't the same situation, but obviously it received a different reaction, of course. And I think one of the first things that President Zelensky called for in one of the very first days of war, he said, Russia will pay reparations. They will pay for what they have done to Ukraine. And let that be the case. But then what kind of reparations? How much? Who settles that question? And we have precedents for this too, you know? There were secret deliberations between the Israelis and the Germans in 1952, and they were very, very contentious, and yet reparations were paid. So I think there's so many different ways in which diplomacy can kind of step in here in ways that it hasn't in recent memory, certainly. And I think some people see that as hope and others see that as, quite the opposite. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, you absolutely see it in these kind of existential questions that officials in the United Nations system are now chewing through, where you have the absolute moral clarity of Zelensky, who is right when he says that the UN has a Security Council that does not provide security, which is born of some kind of original sin, which is that if you trust these people with nuclear weapons, then they have a free pass to do whatever they want because they have vetoes throughout the system. And yet the idea that that body, which is the best thing the world has for securing some form of peace, would just dissolve itself because the majority isn't getting what it wants from Russia over this case, that is not very politically realistic.
Regardless of how this plays out, you know, whatever happens, Ukrainians have this, as you said, this kind of moral clarity about what's going on, the kind of kimono has been opened for them about what NATO and the EU and the UN really are, as if it, I mean, and this was already happening before this full-scale invasion, of course, with the kind of endless promises of EU membership and NATO membership. I don't think, you know, it was such a mystery, but here there's kind of no ambiguity anymore. And at least my Ukrainian friends have been kind of like openly kind of upset about that realization. And one of them posted, she said she evacuated from Kyiv and she's safe with her family, thank God, right now. But she was like, you know, if only they could hear the sounds of air raid sirens in the West. If only we could play it for them so they would know what they sound like every couple of minutes, you know, to have to hide with your child. And she posted a few days before the invasion, she posted a picture of herself on Maidan Square smiling and said, Ukraine is the capital of the free world. And then a few days after that, she was like, you know, I texted her to make sure she was okay. And she said, we are alone in this fight. Just the clarity of that, there's just no way of getting around it.
Linda Kinsler, thank you so much for being a Global Insider.
Thank you for having me, Ryan.
Linda Kinsler's book, Come to This Court and Cry, is published by Bloomsbury and is out in late May. You can pre-order a copy via many websites. Three easy options are Amazon, Bloomsbury.com, or publicaffairsbooks.com. Wait on Lynn produces this show. Our executive producer of audio is Jenny Arment. I'm Ryan Heath. Subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of Global Insider.